Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. In this episode, Adam Brock of The Grow House returns to continue the thread of invisible structures that began in the last episode with Bill Summers. There, we talked about community-developed finance. Here, Adam and I speak more broadly about invisible structures and his emerging invisible structures pattern language, which develops on the ideas of others, including Starhawk, Charles Eisenstein, and more. You'll hear the rest in the interview, and can view them in the show notes at thepermaculturepodcast.com. While you're there, also click on the support tab, where you can find out ways to follow and support the show. Donations, both one-time and small recurring monthly options, are available on that page. This invisible structure theme began when I first spoke with Adam, and I've wanted to follow up with him on it for some time. What we are capable of as individuals is multiplied when we come together. Many hands make light work, whether designing a landscape, working out the details of an alternative economic system, or building community. In permaculture, there's plenty of work on backyard landscape designs, and as Rafter Sass Ferguson's study shows, the work on broad scale is growing. To take these ideas further, we now need to move from the physical and start on the small scale, invisible structures, our friends and neighbors, and then out from there into our community. I'll join you again after the interview. Here's Adam Brock. Adam, would you like to go ahead and give us an introduction to this idea of permaculture and invisible structures, and we can take it from there?
Yeah, I'd love to. The definition I most frequently use for invisible structures, which is the intangible elements that are necessary for systems to function effectively. So obviously that can cover all kinds of different things, depending on what system you're talking about and how you're looking at it. But one helpful way to think about it is Holmgren's permaculture flower that he used in Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability. I think it's actually on the cover of that book, where at the center, at the core of that flower is the ethics and principles. And then all of these petals coming off of the flower are different ways of applying those ethics and principles. And so one of the most familiar petals to most permaculturalists is in land use or agriculture. Another petal of that flower is in the built environment and structures. Another petal might be appropriate technology. And all of those things are, of course, physical structures. Those are ways that we apply the permaculture principles and ethics towards the world that you can physically see and touch and feel. But then there's all these other petals of finance and economics, of arts and culture, of health and spirituality, of education, and of governance, of how we organize ourselves and make decisions as communities. And all of those petals are equally important to a well-functioning society and are equally ripe for application of the permaculture principles and ethics. So when we talk about invisible structures, we're really talking about applying permaculture to all of those different facets of life.
Do you have one of those particular petals that you'd like to take us down as an example, or do you have a more broad overview of each of those?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, you know, maybe start with one or two and see where that gets us. I guess I'll say as well that a big goal of mine in the long term, you know, in terms of my path as a permaculturalist, I see one of my big goals is to take these invisible structures and develop a pattern language to them. So because, you know, a lot of permaculturalists are starting to understand the importance of invisible structures. I think we all know that there are intangible elements that are necessary for systems to function effectively, but we often don't know how to talk about them because you can't see them, because you can't touch them. It's hard to be able to wrap your mind around the specifics of how these invisible structures function and how to apply them across various situations. So there's a lot of kind of specific strategies that people have hit upon, but there's no kind of structure tying them together. Certainly for my own use as a permaculturalist, and hopefully other people will find it helpful, I've been starting to kind of develop this pattern language, which, you know, in case you're not familiar with the pattern language, it was something that was first developed by Christopher Alexander, an architect in the 70s. To express the kind of essential forms of the built environment. In his case, he was an architect, but those essential kind of archetypal forms that make our environment work, And they're usually presented as this kind of set of patterns, a set of strategies that are interrelated to each other. Some are larger and overarching, and then some are very small and unique and specific. But they all connect to each other. And so in any given context, you can kind of draw from these patterns to apply towards your specific design project and come up with a kind of mini language for that project.
This development of a pattern language for invisible structures, are you building on any of the material that's already been presented by some other permaculture practitioners? Or are you kind of starting from scratch?
No, I'm definitely trying to keep this language as closely intermingled with the existing pattern languages that have been developed. So, you know, in Edible Forest Gardens, Volume 2, Dave Jackie and Eric Tonesmeyer developed a pattern language of forest gardens. In Peter Bain's book that recently came out, he developed a pattern language of garden farming. And both of those I've found extraordinarily helpful in my own design work. And, you know, I think ultimately any pattern language I've realized is kind of necessarily personal and necessarily incomplete. So, I'm not trying to make something here that's going to be completely comprehensive and that nobody will ever have to add to after that. But the point is, you know, I'm taking from the existing pattern languages as well as, you know, Christopher Alexander's original pattern language and looking at all of these languages as well as other thought and writing on invisible structures and permaculture that might not be presented in pattern language form, but that is kind of trying to pick out what are the patterns that these authors are talking about and kind of embodying that. So this is certainly something that's not just coming out of my head. It's really drawing from the entire permaculture community as much as it can.
Then could you give us an overview of what this pattern language that you're creating looks like and sounds like in regards to invisible structures? And then maybe we can move that back to my earlier question about some examples about how this would function.
Yeah. Like Christopher Alexander's pattern language and the other ones that have come after it, I think it's helpful to start at the largest scale and then zoom in, you know. And again, there's the principle in permaculture of patterns to details. So let's start at the so-called kind of meta patterns, the patterns that define all the other ones. So I think some of the key things here are the right scale for the right structure. I think, you know, one of the things we see all too often, one of the biggest design failures in our contemporary society is that we're trying to apply things that might work at one scale to scales, in most cases, that are way too large for those patterns to really be functional or effective or healthy. So there's this overarching pattern of understanding what is the right scale for any number of these either invisible or physical structures, and understanding the limits to the effectiveness in terms of scale of any one of these patterns. Another really important one that we come across in physical structures as well is this idea of regenerativity. So just as with our physical structures, say in our garden, we want to design gardens that are regenerative, that take care of themselves, that give back after time more and more. So too, are we looking for the same thing in our invisible structures? So, you know, a helpful way to think about that is, say you're an activist and want to start a campaign or a group. Well, ultimately, you probably want that campaign or group to be something that continues without your ongoing involvement, without you having to constantly be the center of it and push it over and over. And so that's the idea of the regenerative structure. It's something that has a life of its own beyond the person that formed it. I think another really important aspect to invisible structures is this idea of story. And this especially ties back to arts and culture, but really to a lot of these things is, you know, what is the story that we tell ourselves about our society and our place within that society? And how is that currently being told? How can we look towards patterns that reframe that story or tell a different story? How does that shift our perception of what's possible or of the world that we're in? So those are the few of the kind of overarching patterns that I think really start to trickle down into much more detailed and specific patterns farther down the structure.
I think of story and that people are storytellers. We weave all these different pieces of our lives together when we have conversation with people as we try to interrelate and understand others' perspectives from our own place of being. How do you move from that big idea of story then into the social and into the arts and culture?
Like you said, story is how we relate to each other in a lot of ways, and certainly it forms the foundation of a lot of art. I mean, if you look at, for example, art of most of the first millennium, it was kind of couched in the story of the Bible, at least in the West. And so, you know, a lot of the painting and a lot of the poetry and things like that came out of this overarching story that most folks shared of, you know, the Old Testament, as well as the death and resurrection of Jesus. And within that story, people found specific things to pull out and that they found meaningful in their context, in their lives, that helped shed light on what they were going through. Similarly, I think in the last several hundred years, the overarching story has generally been scientific. And so we've looked to science to help give us meaning, to give the world around us meaning. And so, you know, especially if you look in the 20th century of science fiction and of us looking towards the stars, or maybe at the subatomic level or what have you, at the kind of cutting edge of human scientific knowledge, and taking that cutting edge of science and finding meaning from that to give our kind of everyday quotidian lives meaning. And so those are two examples from the past. And so, you know, perhaps in the future, our stories might come from observation of natural systems. They might come from, they might draw from the past, but recombining it in kind of a postmodern way, you know, weaving together creation myths from all kinds of different cultures. It might come from understanding agricultural practices or horticultural practices of pre-industrial societies. But either way, you know, it won't be pedantic. It'll take the form, I'm guessing, of art, of literature, of poetry, of painting, or whatever cultural forms, you know, happen to be in vogue at the time. But telling the story of why things are the way they are today, for example, economic disruption or energy descent, what are going to be the narrative themes that underlie this path that permaculturists like to talk about? Because a lot of people don't really get excited about peak oil in terms of the numbers. Some people really love to talk about that, but for the general population, it's not the numbers that are going to be meaningful. It's going to be the story that we weave about why those numbers exist and where they're heading.
In a way, then, contextualizing those numbers into something that is less about science and specificity and more about the general impact that has on our lives, that we're not telling the stories of carbon in parts per million. We're talking about the impacts that has us on our everyday lives as individuals, and gives an emotional context to these rational figures.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, one story that I tell, usually at the beginning of every permaculture course that I teach, I retell kind of the story of our last, you know, 10,000 years of civilization by using the game of Jenga. And so most people are familiar with that game, where it's, you know, this interlocking stack of wooden bricks. And in the game, you're supposed to pull bricks out of the bottom of the stack and put them on top as tall as you can. I find that to be a really telling metaphor for how humans have interacted with our wealth of natural capital that we inherited. You know, agriculture, as Toby Hemingway put it, is the story of turning ecosystems into people. And so what we did with agriculture is we took bricks out of the bottom, say, you know, a healthy grassland ecosystem, and domesticated it and turned it into a monoculture, and used that to grow the, you know, so-called height of human culture and civilization, and allowed us to expand our surplus so that we could create more people, so that we could have more of a division of labor, so that we could have scientists and artisans and armies and things like that. And that's basically a process that has continued apace for the last 10,000 years of finding more and more efficient ways of pulling bricks out of what's existed in terms of what the natural world has given us, and using those bricks to refashion them into something that will grow the human project and will give us ever and ever greater heights from which to view the things below. But of course, as we all know, the more bricks you pull from the bottom, the more unstable the tower gets until you reach this kind of tipping point and the whole thing falls over. And so that's a story that, you know, reframes our entire history in a way that people look at it in a different light after hearing that story. And they see us going in a different direction, and they see their place within that grand narrative in a totally different way, because then it's about, okay, well, how can we, you know, maybe put bricks back into the bottom, or how can we totally think outside this tower idea and start building buttresses outside of it, or, you know, really get creative, but regardless, stop thinking about just growing up, 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 and think about growing in other ways.
Using the game of Jenga and that 10,000 year history as a metaphor makes me think about the hubris that comes through in the allegory of the Tower of Babel and this idea of being able to build towards heaven. Not necessarily a direct correlation, but they're just the way, though, that that relates to these earlier stories that we tell that have been myths that continually recycle within our society through different religious traditions, through different cultural meaning, and then the way that we could even then perhaps extrapolate that out to what happened in the recent financial downturn in 2008-2009. We grew ever larger and ever higher and find out that that base that we were building on was not secure.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it gets back to that other pattern I mentioned of scale, of that maybe the joint stock company and the corporation as it was originally founded was a very smart design and was a great way of accomplishing things that couldn't have been accomplished otherwise. But once that started to become, you know, the overarching structure of our economy and dominated all of our financial decisions, it started to get out of scale to the point where, yeah, it became too top heavy and was kind of destined to fall apart.
Scale and governance is interesting to me because I've been looking at what's involved in handling natural resources and where those kinds of decisions should take place, because there are certain things that are very impactful on a local scale, such as a timber harvesting or the damming of a river, depending on what watershed that happens to occur in. And that historically, that there's been conversation stretching back about 125 years ago, there were some conversations being had that we should really be dividing our political influence, like our townships or counties and things, that they should be divided along watershed lines. And I think about that scale and wonder what your thoughts are on scale for governance and some of the patterns that you've seen so far in that invisible structure.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it really takes us to kind of some of the critical patterns in what I call social dynamics, which is just, you know, how humans behave in groups. And one of the, I think, key patterns for understanding that is actually drawn very directly from a couple patterns in the natural world, which are this kind of dendritic branching pattern versus the networked pattern. And you see both of these patterns in various places in the natural world, and they each have their role. And then in turn, you see them each in society. And in society, we call that dendritic pattern a hierarchy. And then the kind of networked pattern is a kind of more, usually is a more informal network, or it has, I don't think it has a specific name per se, but you see it in kind of just friend groups or things like that. And so understanding, again, you know, how both of these patterns have coexisted throughout history in human society in ways that we organize ourselves, and then tracing the kind of evolution of how hierarchies have usurped more and more of the functions that these informal networks used to fulfill, and that the hierarchies have now again, grown out of scale. That we have, you know, if you take, say, the government structure, like you mentioned, we have this massive federal government bureaucracy where there's these huge institutions in Washington that are making decisions that affect all of our smaller governmental units without really much understanding of the implications of those decisions. And of course, those decisions are affected by lobbyists and any number of other things that are less actually directly relevant to what needs to be understood to make a good decision. And, you know, you have these same kind of hierarchies in the corporate structure, in our school system. And, you know, hierarchies, again, you find them in nature. They definitely have a very important purpose. They're efficient. They're really a great way of allocating resources and kind of a one-way direction, whether that's from all the branches to the trunk or in the other direction. Either way, they're very efficient at doing that. And indeed, that's why we see them all over the place, is because we live in a culture where the main story is about efficiency. However, they're not as resilient and they're not as responsive. They're not able to change themselves very quickly when the outside context shifts. And they're also not as innovative and not able to respond to feedback in the way that, say, a network structure is. So if you think of mycelium and the way that mycelia, the kind of underground structure of fungi, is able to shuttle nutrients back and forth throughout the forest floor and is able to partner with all these different kinds of tree roots. That's a great example. Or even our own brains function as a network, the network of neurons that allow us to continuously adapt to new situations. You know, that takes a lot of energy from our body to be able to power that network, because it's not as efficient, but yet it's much more resilient, it's much more innovative. And so looking at these different places where networks and hierarchies have been historically, where they currently are now, and how we might want to shift certain hierarchical structures back towards networks in order to, as you said, most effectively kind of manage our common resources, whether those are our watersheds or our forests, or, you know, manage ourselves as communities.
Just for a moment, where would you see society going if we moved towards a more networked system of governance? Do you have like a vision or a story in your mind of what that would look like or where that would go?
You know, it's a huge question. And to tell you the truth, I don't have an end vision. I think it's a process that I see unfolding over many, many generations. I think one place to look for inspiration, or a few places, I should say, to look for inspiration. I think the Occupy movement was many people's first experience of so-called networked governance, where it was, you know, very self-consciously kind of radically democratic, where if not, you know, every single person was involved in every decision, there was at least kind of hierarchy with consent, which I think is ultimately a more realistic way of thinking about these, is that you have maybe kind of a central networked council of representatives or elders, and then there's kind of spokes councils that deal with specific issues, which have their own kind of network structure. So it's not necessarily about shifting everything to a network as much as forming these kind of fractal structures of network and hierarchy embedded within each other. A couple other inspiring examples are the Zapatista movement in southern Mexico and the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain. The Zapatista movement is more political in nature. Mondragon is more economic. But both of them are these very large institutions of, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that are way, way more horizontal, more democratic, and equally as effective as the institutions we're used to thinking of governance or business.
So in your hierarchy with consent, if we think about this as a pyramid, that rather than having a pyramid that would have like 45 degree sides in a traditional hierarchy, or perhaps even sharper, something kind of flatter, a bit squatter, more, as you say, horizontal, as opposed to the higher and higher vertical integration?
Correct. Yeah. And I guess I want to throw out here that the challenge of making things too flat is that you run into this other pattern, which was named by actually a feminist in the 70s, Jo Freeman, called the tyranny of structurelessness. And what that pattern is about is acknowledging that in any group of people, we all have different strengths. We all have different things to bring to the table. Some of us are natural leaders. Some of us are not. And so if you try to impose this idea of everything is totally horizontal and we're all on the same page and we all need to have equal say in decisions, you end up kind of subverting these natural tendencies towards organization that humans have that actually creates more problems than it solves. So that, you know, we shouldn't try and keep everything as unhierarchical as possible because of some ideal of perfect democracy, that, you know, we actually don't work that way either, that we need to understand that there is a place for this kind of giving authority to different people in different situations, but that authority is something that should be taken away and can easily be taken away if the people in charge aren't actually reflecting the will of the people, or if it's seen that they're not reflecting good discernment, good decision making.
I will need to look into that idea of tyranny of structurelessness. Years and years ago, I had a sociology teacher who talked about society and governance, and that we could never reach something that was completely horizontal or fully democratic because there are people who will want leadership and structure in their lives in order to function, that you will have people who will, regardless of what the system is, will buck against it. And that from what you've set forth, it's really trying to find something that's a little bit more, well, this is in my context, to look for something that's a little bit more democratic, a little bit more fair and equal, but understanding that if you go too far in that direction, you wind up introducing more and more inefficiency until the system no longer functions either. So finding some kind of a happy medium between those two will be important.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I kind of see the network and hierarchy thing as almost these yin and yang, in which you're not trying to completely embrace one or the other. You're just trying to find what is the best way to find a dynamic balance between hierarchy and network in the situation that I happen to be in. And so there's never going to be a one-size-fits-all solution of, you know, it's 70% hierarchy and 30% network. It's more about saying, okay, right here, which principles of networked governance make the most sense, and which principles of hierarchy, and how can we apply them in a thoughtful way, just as we're applying everything else in permaculture.
And that goes back again to your idea of scale, and then also to some of the early ideas of permaculture that we have, like that idea of a million villages. We can interconnect and build where it makes sense of appropriate size, and then integrate and cooperate with one another.
One of the things that I find really helpful here is looking at actually some of the physiological limits of the human being and letting that guide our ideas of scale. And this is something that Alexander comes back to a lot in his original pattern language. It's something that Peter Bain in his pattern language talks about. Just for one example, there's this sociological phenomenon called Dunbar's number. I think Dunbar was a sociologist or anthropologist who observed that throughout history, throughout various societies, groups tended to cluster around this optimum size, and looking at what is that size and what are the reasons why groups cluster around that size. Well, a lot of it has to do with the amount of social relationships we're able to maintain at one time and the amount of faces we're able to recognize and things like that. Needless to say, though, that number is, you know, compared to the scale of most of our institutions today, much, much smaller. You know, it's somewhere between 50 and 300.
The number that I've heard often is around 200, but that's just one that I happen to encounter, which is interesting because I believe that that's also around the number of people that you need in order to have a functioning gene pool needs to be around that same number in order to appropriately propagate.
Right, exactly. No, I think 150, 200 is most of the estimates I've seen. And that's a kind of attractor number that a lot of institutions tend to function around. And then there's other numbers too. You know, there's numbers of 500 or 1,000 people that other institutions tend to cluster around, and 10,000 people and 30 people. And so it's not like everything should always be 150 people or 200 people. But again, it's that careful observation of the past and of the present and seeing, okay, this is a scale that's appropriate for a 200 person thing, and this is something we're trying to do that's more of a 500 person thing, and taking it from there.
It will be interesting to see how those ideas become applied as we move forward and begin to engage more of these invisible structures and build these different frameworks to operate within the overall permaculture model.
Well, yeah, and that's really my hope, is that through this pattern language that we can start to really develop a more precise set of tools to allow us to actually design these invisible structures in the same way we design, you know, buildings or gardens. And it's not to say that those designs can't evolve over time, because certainly buildings and gardens do as well, but that you say, okay, well, we know Dunbar's number, we know these things about networks and hierarchies, we know, you know, these basic understandings of patterns of economics, therefore we are going to design a triple bottom line business that affects this number of people and arranges flows of capital in this way by pulling all, you know, weaving all these different patterns together in order to create a structure that is resilient and regenerative.
What do you see as your next step in building this pattern language? Do you feel that you have enough together to put it out into the world for others to see and begin to contribute to, or is this still something that you're working on?
Well, both. I mean, I definitely see the evolution of this pattern language as a collaborative process. And there's certainly, you know, like I said at the beginning, there's lots of ideas in here that I've already drawn from existing pattern languages, from folks like Starhawk and Luby McNamara, who have both recently come out with books talking about some of these invisible structures. And I've been working actually with a lot of other folks in my own permaculture community here in Denver to help think through some of these structures. And, you know, at this point, I'm keeping a lot of them organized on a Prezi document that's available online. And I'd be happy to share that link with you, Scott, and you can share it with the listeners. And it's certainly more of a sketch pad at this point than anything that, you know, is really intended to be presented publicly. But, you know, it might be helpful for folks to see how I'm organizing these different patterns and to get some feedback on them.
I'll gladly share that presentation when you get the link to me out with the audience. I can make sure that that's part of the show notes. Going back to that idea of Dunbar's number and these smaller groups, that idea of like 30 here or 50 there, do you have any more thoughts on those smaller groups? And what did you say earlier? Was that social dynamics and how that might relate to your pattern language?
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I do call it social dynamics. And, you know, while I think there's a lot of interesting ways to talk about groups of 150 or 500 or 5,000, I think, you know, most of the groups we encounter on a regular basis are much smaller than that. And one of the patterns that I've kind of uncovered that I find to be really helpful is this idea of a people guild. Just like we develop guilds of plants in our polycultures, the people guild is this group of, you know, anywhere from 2 to 7 or maybe 10 people that mutually benefit each other, whose skills and talents and strengths all kind of come together to form this kind of cohesive whole where there's, you're trying to maximize mutual cooperation and minimize conflict. And so there's within that a lot of different archetypes of different types of people that might fill out a people guild. So, you know, again, in the same way that you might have kind of like a guild center in the form of a fruit tree, maybe in a people guild, you might have what's called a champion, who's that kind of person who's just willing to push through whatever obstacles are necessary to find solutions to problems. And, you know, they might be a charismatic leader, or they might just be a really hard worker, but they might form the center of that people guild. And then there's network weavers, who are kind of the mycelium of a people guild. And they're the ones that, you know, happen to know everybody in a community and are able to connect people to each other and draw other people into the guild. There are elders, and then there's radicals. So the elders are the ones that have had a lot of experience and are able to counsel everybody else on how to proceed. And then there's the radicals that are kind of always pushing the boundaries of what's possible and questioning why things are the way they are. And those two kind of form this dynamic yin-yang balance. And they need not be actually, you know, elders don't have to be older and radicals don't necessarily have to be younger. It's more about this kind of archetype of what is your personality and what is your role in this specific group. So, you know, you can keep going and get as creative as you want, finding all of these different roles to fill in the people guild. And of course, unlike plants, people aren't these static things where for your entire life, you're going to fill the role of the network weaver. It's more about, in this case, the kind of specific context of that group. But regardless, I've actually found it to be a really helpful tool in, you know, everything from how I pick design groups of people to work together in a permaculture course to how I form teams at the grow house, how we kind of splinter off into groups and accomplish tasks, and even in my collective house, you know, how we make decisions that way.
Which takes me back to the first of Holmgren's permaculture principles that we have to observe and interact in order to find out who these people are going to be and then to put them together in the appropriate groups.
Right. And it takes a lot of self-observation. I mean, ideally, you know, one is able to understand themselves well enough to the point where they can say, okay, I see what's happening in this group and it really needs an elder. You know, so I'm going to, even though I have a lot of radical ideas, there's also a lot of other radical ideas in this group. So I'm going to play that elder role and be the person of caution, you know, or something like that. And I will say that a lot of this idea of the People Guild, I drew from Starhawk's book, The Empowerment Manual, which came out, I think about a year or two ago, which is, you know, really applying permaculture principles to how to function effectively in groups. And there's a lot of great, great stuff in that book. She doesn't use the word people guild specifically, but she talks about these different roles in a effective group and how to recognize and apply them.
And you took that idea and then in turn turned it into this pattern language to fit the structure that you're working within.
Exactly. Yeah. I just kind of took the ideas that were in that book and kind of put them in pattern form.
I like that kind of creative use as we pull in and synergistically apply all this different material from our own lives and make it something meaningful for what we're doing.
Yeah. And you know, like I said, in a lot of ways, I think these pattern languages are very personal. It's kind of what I'm doing here is just compiling my own set of tools that, you know, when I read a book, I say, oh, this is a really cool concept. How can I kind of encapsulate that in pattern form and kind of stick it into my file so that I can continue to draw from it as I encounter other challenges and design projects.
I made a similar comment when I was giving an early permaculture presentation here locally, that even though there are these 12 permaculture principles that kind of form the big ideas coming from Holmgren, that his 12 principles are kind of becoming the foundation on which many people are resting their permaculture ideas, that really the principles are whatever you need them to be at the time that you're working on a design. Even though his 12 might form this base, that someone who's practicing permaculture might have 30 or 40 principles that they use to remind themselves of what they need to do to make their designs as functional within their view of permaculture as possible. And I like this idea of the pattern language is a way to extend permaculture principles in ways that are necessary for a particular piece of design or function. And as you say, making it personal, being able to add to those ideas and remove them as necessary so that, as Bill Mollison, I believe, warned us in the designer's manual, that it doesn't become dogmatic. It's, if you will, living and breathing and growing dynamically and organically as each of us grow as designers and practitioners.
Yeah, I think that's a great vision, and it's certainly pretty close to the way I see the pattern language working in my own practice. I mean, you know, I know we're mostly talking about invisible structures here, but I do want to say at this point that I think it is really helpful to think about a lot of the physical things we talk about in a PDC as patterns as well. And, you know, I think when people first approach permaculture, they mistake the patterns for permaculture itself, where, you know, for example, a greenhouse is a pattern. It's this kind of consistent way of arranging materials and energy in a specific place to achieve specific goals. And within that, it's very flexible, but it's, you know, one pattern which may or may not be appropriate in your design that is related to many other patterns, larger and smaller, that you can choose to apply or not. Or a chicken tractor is a pattern, or a perennial polyculture is a pattern. And so by learning to see all these things we learn about in a PDC as patterns, I think it really helps us understand when to apply them and when not to apply them, and understand their kind of essential malleability, so that, like you said, they don't become dogmatic, as in, you know, a greenhouse must be 20 feet long and 10 feet deep and be heated this way and glazed that way. But that rather it's more this kind of archetypal idea of gathering southern sunlight and storing it and using it to extend a growing season or heat other structures or things like that.
Those patterns form the model for the techniques that we develop out of permaculture.
Right, exactly. And as you move down the pattern language into patterns that are more and more small scale, then they almost become indistinguishable from techniques. I mean, one could write a whole pattern language of greenhouses that gets down to the details of how you attach the glazing to the frame. And there's a pattern for that that's not, again, you know, set in stone, but it works time and time again. And that just becomes, you know, your kind of rules of thumb that after the seventh or eighth greenhouse you build, you know that this is how it worked for the previous six. And so this is the pattern that I'm going to employ again here.
One portion of the pattern language that I want to make sure we touch on before wrapping up is about the economic systems. My last interview was with Bill Summers of the Permaculture Credit Union, and he and I talked about community developed finance from a very like technical, how these things operate, what the options are for doing community development, and what some of the financial systems are that we can use. And I'd like to be able to tie that very technical discussion about invisible structures with your ideas of the invisible structure pattern language and economics.
Yeah, fantastic. I think there's a lot of really rich thought coming out right now around economics with books like David Graeber's Debt, The First 5,000 Years, and Charles Eisenstein's Sacred Economics, not to mention, you know, a lot of the work being done around local currencies and things like that. So I think we're in a really exciting time of thought around reframing the pattern language. And so, you know, again, a lot of this stuff that I talk about in my own pattern language is certainly not my own ideas. It might just be other people's ideas that are kind of repackaged in the pattern form. But I think a really important kind of fundamental pattern to economics that's important to start with is reframing our own understanding of some of the very foundational concepts of economics that have been told to us in one story and we need to come up with a different story for. For example, the terms dollars, capital, and currency. I think in today's story, we're used to thinking of those things as being relatively synonymous, when really, you know, at least the way I teach this stuff, they mean very, very different things. So, you know, dollars are one specific form of currency that have been designed to accomplish a specific set of tasks, which no longer serve us for the most part. And dollars are kind of a, you know, you could call them a currency monoculture, because they have this built-in need to expand. There always need to be more dollars every year than there were the year before because of the way dollars were designed. That means that dollars have found ways to take over many, many different parts of our lives that older currencies that serve similar roles never did. And so seeing that dollars are this kind of currency monoculture helps us realize that there are such things as currency polycultures, and that currencies can come in many different forms, and they're not necessarily always coins or bills or checks or numbers in a computer, but that there's also, you know, social currencies. Currencies are basically just ways of facilitating the flow of value. And of course, we consider things valuable in many, many ways other than dollars. So, you know, really just having that first discussion around dollars and capital and what value really means, I think is fundamental to all these other patterns that follow. But some of the kind of more specific ones that we can talk about are things like the triple bottom line, which is this idea that in addition to trying to meet your single bottom line of financial profit, that you're also holding yourself accountable to social sustainability or regenerativity and environmental sustainability or regenerativity. This is, you know, usually applied to a business where a business is trying to earn a profit, because without a profit, it can't survive and it can't accomplish anything else. But that by doing that, by the very design of that business, it's actively improving the ecosystem around it. It's actively healing the communities around it. And so there's this kind of triple bottom line pattern of businesses that attempt to do all three of these things at once. Just like there's currency polycultures, I also think it's helpful to think in terms of income polycultures. So as individuals that are you know, trying to earn a living and support ourselves, we want to think in terms of diversity and cultivate a number of diverse skills that other people see as valuable and are willing to pay for. Even if they're not willing to pay for all of them in dollars, they're willing to barter something for them. But in any case, that we're cultivating this polyculture of skills that people find useful. So that's another pattern. There's what I call professions of primary production. So it kind of ties back to that previous pattern of all these different skills that one might cultivate. Well, really, you want to probably look at those skills first that are most essential to humans being happy and successful. So primary production refers to, you know, the primary producers in an ecosystem that are the photosynthesizers, the species that are able to synthesize sunlight and turn that into energy that everything else in the ecosystem can then cycle off of. So similarly with these professions of primary production, it's those things that make the rest of society possible. Construction or education or agriculture, of course. So focusing on those as your income polycultures rather than things that are, you know, maybe a little bit more frivolous. What else do we have in this toolbox? One pattern that I got from Larry Santoyo, who comes to teach at our permaculture course every year, is reducing the need to earn. So, you know, before we think about, okay, how am I going to make $30,000 a year from growing food? Well, first ask yourself, do I really need to make $30,000 a year? What am I spending that $30,000 on? And are there any ways I can meet those underlying needs without spending dollars, maybe through other kinds of currencies? For some people, there's actually a lot of wiggle room. For some people, there's very little wiggle room because they're locked into a mortgage and have kids to support. But regardless, at least starting by asking that question, how can I reduce my need to earn, and then proceeding from there to earning what's necessary? It's, you know, kind of analogous to when you're retrofitting a home, making that home as efficient as possible and reducing the load, and then from there trying to you know, meet that load with renewables. And then just a couple other patterns on the economic pedal that I'd like to go over, kind of going back to this triple bottom line idea of, you know, where economics meets healing communities, is this pattern that we employ at the Grow House all the time that I kind of half jokingly but half seriously call one for the money, two for the hood. And that's something that I stole from this guy, Brian Terry, who's a really amazing kind of vegan chef and activist out in Oakland. But anyways, the idea is that you do an activity that is valued highly by people who have money to spend, and you provide that service and generate a profit doing that, but you do that in order to basically subsidize doing something similar or the exact same thing to folks that aren't able to pay for it. So you charge $900 for a PDC so that you can let in other folks for $200. Or you charge $4 for a head of lettuce so that you can sell it to people who live in a food desert for 50 cents or a dollar. And so that pattern we found at the Grow House works really, really well for us, because there's a lot of people who see what we're doing, who want to support local foods, who have the ability to pay a premium for it. And then that allows us to really extend our impact to the folks that don't have that ability. And then one final pattern is this idea of a lending circle, where everybody pools in a little bit of money and puts it in, you know, into the middle of the circle, and then the people in that circle effectively kind of create their own mini bank where they choose who to lend that money that they've all pooled to, and then that person pays the money back potentially with interest, so that the next time around, there's even more money that can be lent out to the next person in the circle. It's a really powerful way of generating wealth without having to rely on traditional instruments of loans and debt and things like that, but really instead relying on your immediate community, the people that know you and trust you.
My understanding is that that idea of a lending circle is very popular in many areas outside of the United States, where it becomes like a community loan service where people will come together and there might be 12 people in the group and each one of them gives a dollar or two a week, and then 1 month somebody gets that pool of money, then the next month somebody else gets the pool of money that they raised in order to have that investment in some kind of a larger purchase that they might not be able to come to normally by trying to save over a year on their own to meet that need.
Right. Yeah, I think these types of structures kind of form naturally wherever the kind of conventional financial capital is scarce. And, you know, we've been living in a place here in America where that kind of traditional financial capital is very free and easily available. But that's not really the case anymore. And I'm guessing it'll continue to become more and more scarce. So I think looking at those other models that have existed in other countries is very helpful.
Well, thank you so much, Adam, for taking the time to sit down with me and share all these different ideas from your developing pattern language. I'll gladly make that link available in the show notes for the listeners to your presentation, where they can go take a look at what you're doing and perhaps comment on it and add to that. Is there anything else that you would like to share with the listeners?
No, not other than the fact that, you know, again, this is definitely a work in progress. I feel like I'm just taking the first steps in a multi-year journey towards developing this pattern language, and it's certainly something that I see evolving a lot over time with the input of many, many people. So I'm grateful to you, Scott, that you've allowed me the opportunity to kind of share the very beginnings of it with folks.
And I look forward to being here with you along the way as this continues to grow and adds to the body of knowledge within the permaculture community and beyond. Thank you so much, Adam, for taking the time to join me today.
Yeah, thank you, Scott.
And that was Adam Brock of The Grow House. If you want to review his online presentation, I've included a link in the resource section of the show notes. Take your time to look it over. If you have thoughts on what to add to the pattern language, leave a comment and help Adam grow this body of knowledge he's working on. I think these pattern languages in the long term serve as one of the best ways to take the vast body of information we have available as permaculture practitioners and break them down into something we can carry with us. Though the descriptors that go with each piece of the language may take several paragraphs or pages to explain in detail, the title for each pattern is short. You can take all the titles from the patterns in Peter Bain's Permaculture Handbook, which is excellent by the way, and write them down on the front and back of a single sheet of paper. The same can be said for the Edible Forest Garden pattern language in Edible Forest Gardens by Dave Jackie and Eric Tonesmeyer. Take those two, add in Alexander's plus Mr. Brock's, and you could have a very powerful reference that extends the ethics and principles of permaculture, allowing us to facilitate designing larger, more varied systems, all in a format you can carry in your pocket. Considering that and Adam's words here, how can you add to the conversation? Along the way, I'd love to hear from you. Email me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266. Coming up in the next few episodes, I have Josh Robinson of the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute. He and I have a nice conversation that starts with his journey to permaculture, which is very reminiscent of, though, in a different way, my own long trek. We also talk about the work of his organization, which is doing a great deal of hands-on projects and education in the San Diego area. If you live nearby and want access to some great in-person permaculture, check them out. And also in that episode, Josh gives us some ideas about dry land strategies after his experiences of living in the American Southwest. Expect that by March 27th. After that, Eric Tonesmeyer joins me again. He's looking at his next big book project and could use your help to get things going. So we talk about his Kickstarter campaign for his book on using perennial crops to capture carbon as well as to replace many of the products that we currently get from petrochemicals. This was another fun time with Eric, and there's a lot for all of us to learn in that episode. That will go live by March 30th. And the last of the shows currently being edited is my interview with Pam Warhurst, chairwoman of Incredible Edible, as well as the British Forestry Commission. She joins me to talk about Incredible Edible and how they're using food and volunteers to build edible landscapes, often without permission. You can find her speech that caught my attention by searching Pam Warhurst TED Talk. She's just as passionate about this subject in our interview together, and as some guests have done in the past, the inspiration of her story left me speechless yet again. That episode will be out on Tuesday, April 2nd. And that wraps up this episode and all the updates. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.